Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Trump has nominated William Barr, who was George H.W. Bush's former attorney general, to be his attorney general. He's also named former Fox News journalist Heather Nauert to be UN ambassador.
And lots of developments are expected today in the Russia investigation. So let's bring in our Friday roundtable. Joining us today, ABC News political director Rick Klein. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And also NPR White House reporter Ayesha Roscoe. Hi, Ayesha.
Hello.
Okay, let's start with the staff changes that happened today or got announced today at the White House. This was the president leaving the White House this morning praising William Barr.
A brilliant man. I did not know him until recently when I went through the process of looking at people. And he was my first choice from day one, respected by Republicans and respected by Democrats.
Okay, so Rick, we've been spending a lot of time this week talking about George H.W. Bush. Interesting timing that President Trump would name his attorney general to be Trump's attorney general.
A remarkable connection and a rare connection between the H.W. Bush alums and President Trump. He is reaching back to an establishment figure in the party, someone who I presume will have a relatively easy time being confirmed in the Senate. But it should be noted that some of the things he's said and written recently might suggest the real reason that President Trump is interested. He has suggested that the Mueller probe has gone off track. He wrote an op-ed that defended his right to fire the FBI director, James Comey, who happens to be testifying on Capitol Hill today. So you can imagine why President Trump may see that resume rise to the top of the pile.
Well, Ayesha, Patrick Leahy, a Senate Democrat, has praised Barr as somebody who could get confirmed. What are you hearing?
It does seem like because he is an establishment kind of conventional Republican who is very well known and respected, especially in Republican circles, that he could get confirmed. But he will face some tough questions about what he has said about the Mueller probe. And also, did he guarantee or tell the president that he would not recuse himself from the special counsel as former Attorney General Jeff Sessions did, and that is what angered President Trump so much. So what type of discussions did they have about recusal? And so you're going to have Barr having to answer those questions.
So let's go from the potentially incoming to the potentially outgoing. There are reports today that Chief of Staff John Kelly is going to either resign or be fired any day now. We have, of course, heard that before. I wonder, Rick, if you can tell us if there's any reason to believe it'll happen this time around.
Our reporting at ABC News is that he is expected to be replaced in the coming days. Question about how the timing of that. But there has been reporting around this in the past. We do believe, though, he will be replacing his chief of staff. Look, it's a time of frustration. I don't think there's any question in the minds of the president. He's showing us on Twitter every day how that is. It is notable that Kelly was brought in to clean up, bring more orderly process to the White House. And I think a lot of people would say he succeeded in that. But he also inherited, in addition to that process, a very chaotic president who continues to do his own bidding around these things. And he'll leave with a legacy of not having changed that much at all.
Ayesha, it's still a work in progress, the new Trump White House. But what is it taking shape as? What is it looking like?
You're going to have people that have shown that they can be loyal to the president and people that are basically able to understand what President Trump wants and what is most important to him. I don't think that President Trump wants to be curtailed. He wants to be allowed to be himself. And you've kind of seen that on the communication side when they brought in Communications Director Bill Shine. You've seen a lot more of President Trump just being out there talking and being himself. But President Trump is known for kind of liking people, really, you know, engaging with them and saying they're the greatest and then kind of turning on them. He said he was very happy with Kelly and that was one of his generals, but now they've fallen out. So it seems like even those people, whoever's brought into this position, may be popular for a bit, but it's a question of how long can you last in this White House where President Trump is pretty can change his mind pretty quickly.
Okay, let's get to the Mueller investigation, because this is supposed to be a big week for the investigation. Court filings due today will indicate whether prosecutors think Trump legal fixer Michael Cohen deserves prison time for lying about how long talks to develop a Trump Tower in Moscow went on during the 2016 campaign. And in a different court, prosecutors will reveal what former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort lied about that caused the collapse of his plea deal last month. There was a Trump tweet storm about this morning. Rick, what do you think the White House is thinking about all of this? And are they expecting something big to happen, which a lot of people have been saying for months now, but is it going to happen now?
There is sheer panic in President Trump's tone around what is about to happen. And the best they can hope for are a lot of redactions, like we saw in the Michael Flynn memo earlier this week. But even in those between those dark lines, there was so much that isn't known that suggests that Mueller is going in new directions. And now for him to detail the cooperation with Michael Cohen and what kind of information he's getting there, we've only heard from Cohen's side on that. And the lack of cooperation on the Manafort side, the question of who Manafort might have been trying to protect by clamming up, by seeing that cooperation agreement collapse. Those will be fascinating, but it is up to Mueller how much he tells us now versus saves for later. There's a cat and mouse game being played at a very high level.
Aisha, is the Mueller report going to come out before Christmas, you think?
I don't know, but I would be very surprised. It seems like Mueller is not necessarily winding up. If anything, it seems like there's more being discovered as we go along, and so much that we in the public don't know about. And so it doesn't seem like this is a process that is headed towards a very quick conclusion. And that may be what President Trump is so upset about. He keeps saying, this shouldn't happen to me. I'd be doing so much better if this wasn't going on, this investigation.
Mm-hmm. James Comey is testifying today. The former FBI director is, and he would only testify behind closed doors on the condition that his testimony be released to the public. And I guess that's supposed to happen within 24 hours. What are we looking for in that? What are we expecting to hearing and to be hearing through the testimony?
Well, we're already hearing from some Republicans that he's not answering all the questions. This, to me, is really a last gasp of the Republican majority. The questions that they have for James Comey, we're told going in, are really about the Clinton email investigation, not about obstruction of justice, not about his brief tenure under President Trump or his firing by President Trump. So they're looking backwards. And you, as you said, we're going to see the testimony come up transcript form in the next day or two. We're already hearing complaints from Republicans that there aren't complete answers, which I think is about to be expected. They're treating Comey as basically a hostile witness.
I wonder if we can pivot to the economy now. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow went on CNBC to praise Donald Trump's handling of the economy. Let's hear what he had to say.
I think you're going to see the budget deficit come way down as a share of GDP because of faster economic growth. I mean, you know, we're in a really good spot here, if you ask me.
And there were figures out that the U.S. added today 155,000 jobs in November, hiring slowing modestly. Aisha, how nervous is the White House about the stock market turmoil of this past week? It was way up and way down.
I think any White House would be very concerned, and this White House especially, because part of what President Trump has campaigned on and said, kind of promoted about himself, is that he has been great for the economy. And when you look at the economy, it has been doing really well. But with all of this uncertainty around trade and around other issues, there is a concern that it's affecting the market. So the question is, does the White House then take that? And in these negotiations with China, do they try to harder to reach a deal and to find some type of agreement to at least remove that uncertainty from the market? But we'll see, because China and the U.S. have been going back and forth for a long time now.
I thought you were going to say that there was a special concern in this White House about the stock market because there are so many billionaires in the administration that probably have a lot of investments themselves, even though they're probably not supposed to be looking at those, or they're not supposed to be handling them on a day-to-day basis. But let's face it, Rick, there are a lot of rich people in this White House.
And maybe they're insulated from the ups and downs. Look, this is a dicey area, and it's something that's privately giving concern to people around President Trump, Republican strategists who are looking forward to the reelection. They know that his political appeal has been based on his vision and his views on the economy. And if the economy stumbles, that's a major blow. And the fact that this trade war now seems like it is just heating up with China, Wall Street not believing the assurances that they're getting from the president, in addition to overall signs of the economy maybe slowing, there are a lot of problem areas on the horizon.
I want to ask about one more thing, which is, you know, we've been watching what's happening in North Carolina and this last possible seat that the Democrats could pick up. We've been talking a lot this week about President George H.W. Bush, president number 41. It is now possible that 41 could be the number of seats that Democrats picked up in the midterms, which would be a huge blue wave. Aisha, what do you think of that? It just continues.
It would be a huge deal. And of course, that's what President Trump doesn't want to focus on. He wants to focus on the gains in the Senate. But it's a huge deal for the Democrats, who were coming off of this huge loss in 2016. And now they kind of have this momentum for them. They have these huge pickups and gains in the House. And they can really say that there was a blue wave and that they were able to kind of run against what President Trump was saying. And that now they can do the investigations and things that they want to do to kind of bring some accountability to the White House.
Aisha Roscoe, NPR White House reporter. We've also been speaking with Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Taliban launched a coordinated attack overnight on two Afghan army outposts in western Herat province. They killed more than a dozen soldiers and took 21 others prisoner. This is the latest in a series of attacks on the country's beleaguered security forces. U.S. troops have been fighting in Afghanistan since 2001, and they are also taking casualties. Six Americans have been killed in action there since November. Reporter Jennifer Glass joins us from Kabul. Jennifer, welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, Lisa.
We're also joined by Jason Dempsey, senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. He's a retired Army officer who served two tours in Afghanistan and one in Iraq. Jason, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Just first off, given the recent developments around the media and attitudes toward it, I just want to say thank you to you and your team for playing this essential role of free press and democracy. And folks like Jennifer, who are overseas reporting for years on end and getting the story to the American people from dangerous places, thank you for your service.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you. And yeah, Jennifer, why don't we start there? You have been in Afghanistan for how many years now?
Seven and a half.
So you have seen a lot of the kind of attacks, such as what we heard about in Herat province last night. Maybe you can tell us what this means for people on the ground there.
Well, it's been a really dangerous time. Here in Kabul last month, a number of brutal attacks killed dozens and dozens of people, one of them killing 55 people during a religious ceremony while they were actually reading the Quran. That was carried out by the Islamic State. The attack last night in Herat was carried out by the Taliban, killing more than a dozen Afghan soldiers. The Afghans are taking punishing casualties, an average of about 25 deaths a day, with many more than that injured every day. The incoming general of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kenneth McKenzie, calls that unsustainable. He also admits that Taliban have fought the Afghan security forces to a stalemate. And we have seen Taliban attacks around the country. They control or contest about half of the country, Lisa, and really very much a sense of how much they do control. They've been levying taxes on the people that they, in the areas over which they have control, pretty regularly. They have their own institutions. They have their own courts. So in the areas that they control, they certainly have a real system of running that area. And many of those areas, the government can't go or really has very little influence.
Jason Dempsey, you have spent time deployed in Afghanistan. What does it sound to you like when you hear how much control and how much of a even bureaucracy the Taliban has set up there? Because that's exactly what American forces were helping Afghan forces, they were trying to help them avoid.
The Taliban are succeeding politically. I think Mattis recently said that, you know, the Taliban can't win at the ballot box. Well, they're not winning at the ballot box, but they're winning at the local level. They are setting up services. They are establishing legitimacy, for good or ill, in these outlying provinces. In Helmand, they've essentially had partnerships with Afghan government, kind of working hand in hand in a very unofficial, official way. It shows that they're looking at this from the long game. And they are doing the most fundamental thing is they're winning local political battles. Meanwhile, we, part of the coalition forces and the Afghans, are trying to win this national battle all at once.
When you say we're trying to win it all at once, we've been there for 17 years now.
Absolutely. And part of the fundamental challenge of this is we are trying to create both a government and a military that looks like ours instead of one that works for Afghanistan. And so we've got this wildly resourced force that has all the tools and resources that the American military can provide them, but they can still barely hold their own against Taliban fighters. And it's certainly not for a lack of firepower. It's for a lack of political legitimacy.
And Jennifer, how do you interpret that? I mean, you said 25 Afghan troops are killed every day. What is the legitimacy that's missing?
Jason makes a very, very good point. Look, on the ground, a lot of people believe a lot of what the Taliban stand for, that they want an Islamic country, that they want, in many cases, rule of law. Corruption is a huge frustration, and that is, I think, a very big hindrance to the Afghan government, because you see corrupt officials, you see corrupt police. Here in Kabul, it's very difficult to enforce the rule of law. Just this week, a block and a half from my house, there was a court order that the attorney general and security forces tried to enforce. The folks inside didn't want to give up the property in a very prosperous area of Kabul, Shahrinow. They fired an RPG at those police, and a 24-hour siege went on. This is rule of law in the center of Kabul. To give you a sense of what the security situation is, to give you a sense of how people view the government, and of course we have these strongmen around the country who have power of their own, either through money or through their own militias. They are the enforcers in those areas, and I think that's the big challenge for the government and its legitimacy.
We heard this week from Marine Lieutenant General McKenzie. He's the man who was nominated to command all American forces in the Middle East. He called the Afghan war a stalemate, which we have heard before. He was also asked a question about what he would say to Americans and Afghans who wonder why their loved ones are still being killed in this war. And here's what he said.
Sir, what we are doing is we are protecting the homeland of the United States from being attacked. That's what you say to the Americans, and that's a clear, visible, tangible effort that we can honor them for. For the Afghans who have died, it's an attempt to come to a long, peaceful political settlement in their country, and I think that too is an honorable goal. I think Afghans and Americans who've died in action in Afghanistan have all been pursuing an honorable and reasonable objective.
Jason, you were one of those soldiers in Afghanistan. What's your response to that?
I don't think the question is what is the mission, right? We all understand what the mission is about. We understand why we initially went there. The question is really about how do we explain our continued failure? The question has to boil down to, is this really the best we can do? And have we examined all alternatives? Have we questioned some fundamental assumptions? Or are we just going to keep on with more and more of the same year after year after
what,
year?
What assumptions are you talking about?
Well, for one, the assumption, you know, we started with this idea that we could create an Afghan state in our image. And one of the fundamental conundrums exposed by the Trump administration's supposed new strategy was, well, we're not going to do nation building. Well, that's fine. But what we're doing is we're still building a military in Afghanistan and a government structure that assumes a Western-style nation exists. And so we're sending this military out there that, again, only exists and can only be sustained with years and years and billions of dollars of American support, and they're losing or they're being held to stalemate against an enemy with vastly fewer resources. So we really have to get at this isn't a military problem to be solved. And unless we want to stay there forever, we really need to get back at how do we get to a point where Afghan National Security Forces and the Afghan government can assert some kind of legitimacy, because they may be winning in toe-to-toe battles, but they're losing hearts and minds.
Jennifer Glass, in Kabul, the Trump administration has been holding direct talks with the Taliban. The Afghan government is holding talks with the Taliban as well. What are you hearing about those?
Well, Zalmay Khalilzad, who is the U.S. Special Envoy for Reconciliation here, was just in Kabul yesterday. He flew to Moscow. He's on his third trip around the region in as many months. There's a lot of urgency on the American side to get things started. And so the Afghan government hasn't spoken to the Taliban yet. There was a high peace commission group that did sit with the Taliban in Moscow last month. These have so far been talks about talks, but there is certainly a sense of urgency on the part of the United States. You've seen Khalilzad here in the region quite a lot, talking. He's been in countries, Qatar, in the Emirates, in Pakistan, countries that host Taliban leaders, trying to figure out who he can negotiate with. The Afghan government has put together an initial negotiating team. The real question is, what do the Taliban want? Are these real talks? Will they actually really lead to anything? There was a big moment of hope in June. There was a three-day ceasefire, the first ceasefire in 40 years of war. And there was a lot of enthusiasm and hope when Taliban fighters were here in Kabul looking for ice cream stands. And you'd see them wandering around the streets of Kabul. And they hadn't been in this city in 17 years. And of course, it's grown. It was about 500,000 then. It's more than 5 million now. It gives you the sense that the people really want peace. The question is, how do you get there? And there is a lot of feeling here that perhaps the Taliban's latest offensives are really about trying to give them more leverage on the ground in any future peace negotiations.
Any final word from you on hearing that, Jason Dempsey?
The result of these talks, or any kind of peace negotiation with the Taliban, we're ultimately going to get something that falls very short of our original goals. And this is where we really need not just military leadership, but political leadership to get in and explain to the American people how we're meeting our fundamental mission. But you know what? We've got to give up a few things. The Taliban are going to be – they're going to have a say. And Afghanistan is not going to look like the United States. It's going to look like Afghanistan, like it always has been. The question is, how do we create that or get to a point where Afghanistan can be Afghanistan and still not be a threat to the United States?
Jason Dempsey, senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and reporter Jennifer Glass in Kabul. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
We've been hearing about today's jobs numbers from the Labor Department. The U.S. economy added 155,000 jobs last month. That was less than economists expected. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. He joins us now. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
So first of all, markets dropped again this morning after this jobs report. Some think that this report may help push the Fed towards a wait-and-see approach for rate hikes, but still a big drop.
Maybe. The Fed signaled yesterday that maybe they won't do another rate hike as soon as possible. But I think the markets are in a bad mood anyway, and not much could improve them on the job front. I'll tell you what stands out. Look, we got 3.7% unemployment. That's the third month in a row. On average, 155,000 net new jobs, which brings the last 6 months' average to about 195,000 jobs a month. You know, last year, or at least for much of this year, we've seen above 200,000. So we've got some slowing. But I'll tell you what, if I look at the fact that wages are up 3.1% compared to a year ago, what I'm seeing here is that as the labor market gets tighter, employers have a slightly harder time finding employees, and that may explain some of the slowdown in hiring. It also may just be that we're slowing down as an economy. It's too early to tell.
And a lot of worry about the trade war with China this week. Now, we got some data from the Commerce Department yesterday that tells us how the trade relationship is going. And the U.S. trade deficit, which President Trump has been saying is way too high, hit its highest level in 10 years last month, despite the tariffs and everything else. What's happening?
Yeah, so this would be this is either the president doesn't understand this or you know, there's something else at play here. But the bottom line is we are continuing to import more than we're exporting. Part of that is because in imposing these tariffs, everybody imposed what they call countervailing tariffs on American goods. So we ended up exporting less soybeans and, you know, a whole lot less stuff. And that's part of the issue, that this isn't fixing the underlying problem that this president has identified and President Obama identified and Bush and Clinton and Bush before him. They all want to export more, and generally that's done through negotiation and better economic pricing. The trade war stuff isn't helping because other people are shutting down who otherwise would have been buying American goods, and they're just not doing so.
And as you look at what's been happening in the last week with the U.S. and China, do you expect that they're going to be able to reach a deal at some point?
Well, one can never guess with President Trump. Things start to get really bad, including the arrest in Canada of this Huawei executive who's very closely tied to the Chinese government. And then suddenly a deal comes out. So it's never clear. That's how it worked with NAFTA, right? Canada got shut out, and then suddenly there was a deal. Markets are saying that the uptick in tensions with China is not good, and that's basically why we've seen such a rough market this week. But I got out of the guessing business about what Donald Trump is actually up to some time ago.
Okay. One more thing. The oil markets. President Trump has been saying it's a good thing that the oil prices have been pretty low, but now OPEC and Russia have reached a deal today to cut oil production to reduce the glut.
Yeah, and America is now a net oil exporter, by the way. So oil below $50 a barrel is actually bad for American employment in the oil sector. But we've seen oil go up a little bit, about $53 a barrel now. Russia's agreed to cut 200,000 barrels a day. OPEC's cutting 1 million barrels a day. And as a result, you're going to see oil prices stabilize. In America, you want oil $50 to $60 a barrel. It gives you relatively cheap gas and keeps people employed.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, have a great weekend.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Microsoft released a study this week that finds that 162 million Americans do not have regular access to broadband internet service. That's more than six times the estimate by the Federal Communications Commission. And it paints a stark picture of the internet haves and have-nots in this country. Susan Crawford is professor at Harvard Law School. Professor, half of all Americans do not have reliable high-speed internet access, according to this new study. The numbers are even more dramatic than what was already pretty worrying in the figures from the FCC. How did Microsoft arrive at that number, and who do you believe?
Well, there are really two stories here. One is about lousy data. The FCC has been relying completely on self-reported and incredibly coarse data from the carriers themselves, which is based on who might have access to a particular connection within a census block. A census block can be as large as a square block in Manhattan with thousands of residents, or 8,500 square miles in Alaska. And if one person in that census block is able to get access at any price, no matter how outrageous, the FCC counts that census block as served. Microsoft has, through looking at usage of its own products, been able to show that many, many more Americans are not using the internet at home at the speeds that the FCC counts as high-speed internet access. And that is 25 megabits per second downloads, as defined by the FCC, and 3 megabits per second upload.
So what does 25 megabits or less look like? What does that allow somebody to do?
Well, you can download a high-capacity video at that speed and watch it. The problem is it doesn't allow for things like swapping huge files around, which would be necessary for working from home with large data businesses. And it doesn't allow for symmetric capacity, meaning that you can't upload, you can't be part of the conversation unless you also have at least a 25 megabits per second upload connection, making it difficult to participate, as the rest of the world plans to, in producing information and content as well as just consuming it.
Why would the FCC set the bar so low?
I think they were driven by what the industry told them was reasonable. The FCC has always suffered from this, that it's a bit captive to the companies that it purports to regulate. In other countries, the standards are far higher.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that. The U.S. is lagging behind other countries in terms of high-speed internet access, including countries in Europe. How far behind are we?
Well, figures vary on this one. It's very clear that countries in Northern Europe, like Sweden, for example, are pushing towards very high penetration of what's called fiber to the home, basically unlimited capacity at very, very cheap costs. China is trying to get 80% of its household connected to fiber to the home in the next few years, and they'll be charging, $20 to $30 a month. The U.S., by contrast, we have maybe 10% of the country connected to world-class internet access, which is fiber, and no real plans for an upgrade where it isn't present right now in the United States.
Is it mostly not present in rural areas? Is this an urban rural issue?
So access in rural areas is extremely poor. Usually people are relying on terrible copper DSL connections or maybe even satellite, which is very expensive and subject to lots of delay. We also suffer from a socioeconomic internet access divide. So not having a great wire at home is very tightly correlated with low income. So even in the great city of New York, something like 2.5 million New Yorkers don't have an internet access connection at home.
So give us an example, and I know you've just written a book about this. Give us an example of how this is affecting real people in various parts of America.
Well, it's very similar to what happened with electrification. For decades, farmers in America did not have electricity while their cousins in the metros had it. And that meant that they were living lives of real desperation. That persisted for a long time until FDR got involved in the 30s. So we're seeing the same kind of thing now with internet access. It used to be that someone would say, well, I've got enough to turn on a light bulb in my home, and maybe that's plenty. They had no idea what they could be doing using lots of electricity, automating their production lines, making it possible to work at home, and living lives of opportunity. We're missing out on the most advanced healthcare in the world. We're missing out on terrific education opportunities in general for Americans. But mostly, we're missing out on an entire generation of new jobs, new industries, new ways of making a living that are going to come from the countries that have this very high capacity access available to a large market at a very low cost.
What do people do in areas where they either can't afford internet access or don't have regular access to high-speed internet?
Well, basically, they're living decades behind the people in metro areas who do have that access. They're not able, for example, to assume that their kids can do homework at home. Rather, they're having to send those kids to the public library in town or maybe the McDonald's that has some little drip of wireless access. It's like not having enough air to breathe. It's an essential for thriving lives in every corner of America.
What, in your mind, and I know there are disagreements about this, but to your way of thinking, what would rectify that?
Well, right now what's happening is that local communities are taking matters into their own hands, ensuring that their towns and cities have terrific public options in the form of wholesale fiber networks. That's happening in more than 700 cities around the United States. Eventually, as with electricity, that will shame the federal government into acting. Three-quarters of Americans from all sides of the political spectrum believe that this should be a utility, that government should be playing a role. It'll take national leadership to get to that point, and it's going to take time, but I do believe we'll get there eventually. We have to. Right now, we are sinking, and it's going to be important for us to regain the lead.
Susan Crawford, professor at Harvard Law School. She has written a book about the state of fiber optic networks in this country. It comes out next month. It's called Fiber, the Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. Susan Crawford, thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
This week marks the 50th anniversary of the television show that was the re-coronation of Elvis Presley as the king of rock and roll.
You're looking for trouble? You came to the right place. Looking for trouble? Just look right in my face.
It was called Singer, as in the sewing company. Singer presents Elvis. It became known, though, as the 68 Comeback Special.
My daddy was a green-eyed man to judge because I'm evil. My middle name is misery.
Let's set the scene. In 1968, Elvis was far removed from being the king of rock and roll. He wasn't even a lowly prince. 8 years of cheesy Hollywood movies had seen to that. It seems unthinkable now, but one day during rehearsals that year, he and the guys in the studio took a break standing out on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, and people just strolled right past him. Elvis hadn't been on TV in 8 years or on stage in seven. He seemed irrelevant, so he was petrified of being televised coast to coast, sitting on the little square soundstage in Memphis with a few of his old bandmates. His manager, Colonel Tom Parker, had wanted the show to be an hour of Christmas songs, but the producer, Steve Binder, had a different idea. He wanted to spotlight the real Elvis. Elvis did, too.
Rock and roll music is basically gospel or rhythm and blues.
Elvis may have been uncomfortable ad-libbing with the audience, but he was supremely comfortable singing his favorite music, gospel.
I used to lie. I used to cheat. I used to lie, cheat, step on people's feet. I used to lie, cheat, and step on people's feet. But now I'm stepping on the glory. Salvation is my beat.
The 68 comeback special was NBC's highest rated show of the year. 42% of TV watchers watched Elvis. That night, 50 years ago this week, he returned to his throne by returning to his roots. Gospel, a little country, a lot of blues, and a nod to Christmas.
My favorite Christmas song of all the ones I've recorded.
I'll have a blue Christmas without you. I'll be so blue just thinking.
British Prime Minister Theresa May is deploying more than two dozen members of her government across the United Kingdom to rally support for her deal on leaving the European Union. But even members of her own party say they plan to oppose her plan when it comes up for a vote on Tuesday. Conservative Party MP Lee Rowley spoke during debate in the House of Commons yesterday.
I do not want to make my country poorer, and I know what will make my country poorer. What will make my country poorer is the inability to sign meaningful trade deals. It is the inability to be flexible, to take advantage of the global growth which is coming outside of the European Union.
And here is Prime Minister May speaking on the BBC.
When we leave next March, it'll be nearly 3 years since the vote of the referendum. The referendum, you know, people were divided between Remainers and Leavers. Now is the time for this country to come back together again.
Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, we spoke to you earlier this week, but where do we stand today, just days before this crucial vote?
I think, if anything, things are worse than when we last spoke. I'm sorry to say, Jeremy. I mean, they're certainly worse for Theresa May. I think any idea that somehow she was going to get momentum, that this debate in Parliament was going to change people's minds, I don't think there's been any evidence of that whatsoever.
Do you think that it's possible that this vote will be postponed, that it won't happen on Tuesday?
Never say never when it comes to Brexit, Jeremy. You should know that. I mean, at the moment, Theresa May is sort of hurtling towards this vote in the same way that you might watch a kind of car hurtling towards a brick wall. Mm. And it's certainly the case that some in her government are saying, hang on a minute, Prime Minister, maybe this is not such a great idea. But so far, the foot is on the accelerator and off she goes, Jeremy.
And she is sending out these foot soldiers around the country to rally support for her plan. How do you think they're going to be received?
I think it's going to be tricky. I think the real problem, the Prime Minister mentioned it there about the way in which the country is divided. 2.5 years on from the referendum, it's just incredibly hard changing people's minds. I guess the only hope she might have, given the way the parties work, and it's sort of similar to the way things work in the United States, that if your local party members, the people, you know, that go and deliver the leaflets and all that kind of stuff when there's an election on, if you were to get feedback and pressure from them on their member of parliament to say, actually, we'd like you to back the deal or not back the deal, maybe that would have some kind of an effect. But actually, it seems to me that MPs haven't really moved much either way, because Brexiteers think that this deal, they've never liked it from the start. They think it feels the UK far too close to the leaves the UK far too close to the EU. And Remainers look at the deal and think, this is just nuts. This is nowhere, nothing like as good as being in the EU, and leaves us far too distant.
There was supposed to be a debate, a head-to-head debate between the Prime Minister and the Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and that has now been cancelled. Why is that?
Do you know, I'm tempted to say that if there's one thing that we have in Britain, which lots of Americans will know, our TV is great, right? Mm-hmm. So on the Sunday nights, you can watch penguins doing all sorts of great things in Antarctica, and you can watch extraordinary dramas. I mean, it's what we Brits are good at. So the idea of Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May debating Brexit, where the joke has always gone that it would be a debate between a woman who doesn't really believe in Brexit defending her deal up against a man who, of course, is a secret, they would say, Brexit believer, as a, you know, as a hard left socialist, who's saying that actually he wants to remain. So the idea is that it wouldn't have made great viewing anyway, but they just couldn't get the optics right. And I suspect that Downing Street may have realised that in the end, the sort of hope that the Prime Minister, who is, I don't want to sound too critical, but she's a pretty hopeless performer on TV. The idea that that would have somehow clinched it, being in some tedious debate with Jeremy Corbyn, I think in the end, everyone decided they'd much rather Mr. Corbyn and Mrs. May alike, they'd rather just sit at home and watch the penguins themselves.
Okay. So as we get closer to this date of Tuesday, if it doesn't get through, which is, I guess, the expectations, what you're saying, that there's not a lot of support for this deal, then where do we go next? What happens next?
Right. Seeing as I was way too long on that last answer, I'll be quick. If it's only by a few votes, she could try again if it's just a small defeat. If it's by a much bigger margin, her deal is gone and maybe she's gone, then that opens up the other options, which is leaving with no deal, leaving with a different deal to hers, a second referendum, a general election, and my personal favourite, Jeremy, who knows?
Okay, well, we'll find out. Rob Watson, the BBC's political correspondent, ahead of the big day next Tuesday, the vote in Parliament on Theresa May's Brexit plan. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And now, Lisa, to a Brexit of a different sort. The Hawaiian monk seal research program said it had to remove an eel from a monk seal's nose. The eel may have been cornered and tried to escape and went into the nose, or it may have been eaten by the seal, they say, and came out the wrong way. Apparently, this has actually happened a handful of times in the past few years. Either way, I feel for this seal, who is now on an even keel after the eel was removed from its nose for real.
Well done, Jeremy.
I will tweet a picture at Jeremy Hobson. The good news, Lisa, by the way, is that there are actually a lot of monk seal pups that have been born, a record number in the Hawaiian Islands this year. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.